magazine. You don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Donovan Bennett for a Saturday morning. Lots coming your way in the next couple hours. We will have a look at the start of the NHL season. Maple Leafs, exciting, if not winning every game. Bunch of blown leads. Auston Matthews, plenty of goals. Edmonton Oilers, good all of a sudden. Can they keep it up? And the Raptors season about to crank up on Wednesday. We'll have a preview of the upcoming NBA season as a whole. Talk some baseball as well. World Series matchup is almost complete into Game 6 of the NLCS. Of course, the winner of the Cubs and Dodgers is going to meet the Cleveland Indians in the World Series. All that and more coming up in just a bit. But, gents, we got to start with the Blue Jays, who are done. It's over. No more Blue Jays. They lose in five games to the Cleveland Indians, an Indians team who had no starters. But they had an incredible bullpen, and boy, did they use it in those five games. A disappointing conclusion to the season for the Toronto Blue Jays, but they only won 89 games. The Indians all season long were the better team. And in those five games, Donovan, I suppose they showed it.
Yeah, they did. And Francona was masterful with that bullpen, really with all his decisions. I think, aside from maybe walking Donaldson to get to Encarnacion, did he make a managing decision that didn't pan out? And even, I mean, Donaldson was hitting 400 in the series, so that's not the worst decision in the world. But yeah, they just ran into a team that was on fire. They weren't even really on fire offensively. They were hitting, you know, in the high 100s, but every time they got a guy on, they were able to manufacture runs and get him home. And once the game was in the fifth or sixth, it was over.
Yeah, the games had a definite fait accompli feel to them when you wind up sort of not seeing them hit those other pitchers. Like when Ryan Merritt gets out of five innings, it's like, holy cow, like this is a situation in which we have to be able to hit the guy who's never basically played professional baseball before at this level.
Well, let's throwing high 80s,
right,
attacking the zone.
Well, like, and not even... You know, on the corners, you look at the breakdown of where his pitches were when he exited after 4 1/3. There was a lot of middle, up, and Blue Jays had two hits off him. So, yeah, we can give credit to the Cleveland Indians, and certainly Andrew Miller's ridiculous. He's a joke. Like, I don't know how you make contact. Well, you don't, generally, against him. And Cody Allen was spectacular. The entire Indians bullpen was great. And sports, baseball, you're going to have this aspect. Do you give credit to the other team, or do you look at yourself and say, we lost that? I think there's a very, very much a combination of things that happened with the Blue Jays, because they pitched well.
Yep.
They could not hit a lick, which maybe brings us to the next point of discussion. What happens next? Where do they go from here? Because the pitching all season long was great. Bullpen struggled early. They seemed to fix those problems, those holes, with the additions of Joaquin Benoit, Jason Grilli, and Joe Biagini filling a larger role. Starters were really, really good, start to finish. And then the Blue Jays had one of the best ERAs in baseball. But the offense was very uneven. It was not that 2015 Blue Jays offense, Craig, that just bashed everybody's brains in, hit five home runs a game, scored double digits every other day, it seemed. So what do they do from here? And we'll get to the pending free agents. Is there a philosophical change that needs to take place as far as the offense?
I'm not totally convinced there is a philosophical change that needs to happen. But I mean, you know, it was interesting seeing them go down 0-2 in a lot of at bats and then still sort of swing super hard where the, you know, the traditional take would be, well, you're just hitting for contact now. You're just trying to get on base. You're just trying to get the bat and the ball, and they're still going super hard, or their windup. You know, we saw it a lot in this last series where guys were just sort of waiting for their pitches and getting struck out looking. And I mean, I don't know if there's a real philosophy or if that was just sort of catching them on a bad stretch. And we saw them have a bad stretch through September when they were under 500. And we thought, I'm not sure about you guys, but I think a lot of people were thinking that this team was going to get bounced in the wild card if they got there. And then they wound up sort of reverting to 2015 form, doing the same things. Like they didn't change their philosophy and they looked fantastic for four games and swept the Texas Rangers. So I'm not sure that, you know, the personnel is going to dictate a massive change, but I don't know that you need a real strategic change because we've seen it work. We saw it work this season at, you know, nice stretches.
I would say, and let me know if this sounds like a cop-out, but here's the reality that I see. Hey, they were one of the final four teams left in the playoffs. That's mm-hmm. great. So they were one of four teams that had a chance winning the World Series. I said this before the playoffs started, and I still believe it to be true. In baseball, the playoffs are a crapshoot. Anything can happen. They could have lost to the Orioles in the wild card game. That's a one-game playoff. If they lose to the Orioles, it's a totally different conversation we're having mm-hmm. right now, and that's one game. Baseball is definitely not supposed to be evaluated in a one-game sample size. To me, the greater evaluation should be what happened during the regular season, and that was almost without question a disappointment considering how well they pitched. They didn't get to 90 wins. They needed game 162 to make the playoffs. I know things look rosy, and boy, a lot of people in this city had visions of World Series titles dancing in their heads naturally in an American League Championship Series for the second straight year. It's all well and good. I think this team, by and large, underperformed its expectations, one, and maybe the actual roster players that were on this team.
I wouldn't go that far just because, one, their division is such a juggernaut. So they didn't get out of it, but to get out of it and make the playoffs.
Yeah, but they had a above 500 record against everybody except for the Tampa Bay Rays in their division.
Yeah, but I think that's testament to the fact that they are a good team. Anytime you have three champagne celebrations in just over a week, like you're doing something right. But I do think that they will be, you know, they will be making a mistake if they don't learn from the last two postseasons and they've, you know, lost to two teams who had superior bullpens and who were superior at manufacturing runs. And everyone was excited when they beat the Texans and they're, you know, hitting the long ball off of very good pitchers. But when it came down to it, they won that series with Josh Donaldson being aggressive on the base pass and really stealing a run and putting pressure on defense. And in the postseason, when you're facing the top ends of staffs and you're facing relievers now more often in high leverage situations, not just at the end of the games, I think being able to get a guy over is of the utmost importance. And really on this team, we saw a lot of long swings. Who was really hitting to all fields? Donaldson, Zeke, Carrera, but other than that, Saunders at times. Mm-hmm. So I think from an approach standpoint, I don't know if you can really say we're just going to be, the monsters of the Midway and just crush home runs and get to the World Series that way.
I'd say it's, disappointing in that way that you didn't expect to get the kind of starting pitching that you got. And I mean, your bullpen, while not being a bunch of world beaters, actually comported themselves very well after a very rough start to the season.
Yeah.
So you wound up having that in your back pocket and you weren't able to score the runs. Whereas last year it was sort of like you were kind of expecting 9 or 10 most nights, especially down the stretch, right? Like that's just sort of the amazing team that you had. And so for one part of the team to step it up so incredibly and the other part of the team to kind of just flag exactly in the same amount the other part was stepping up, that was frustrating. I felt like that was sort of something that we didn't expect to see happen and it kept happening over and over again.
I will say as far as like that's what you're talking about, Donovan, has been a common refrain, if not all season, certainly second half of the season on, about this team, the swing's too big, they can't manufacture runs, there's not enough contact, there's not enough small ball, and I'm doing air quotes, this is radio, so you can't see that. Cleveland Indians, they may have the ability to do that. They did not. That's not why they won the series. They hit a bunch of home runs against the Blue Jays. That's why they won the series, not because they were bunting people over. In fact, I think in the couple of times they tried to bunt a guy over to third base with less than two outs, they failed to score the run each and every time. So, yes, well, I'm not sure whether I agree with the overall sentiment about a change in offensive philosophy for the Blue Jays. I don't point to that as being a reason why they lost this series. They didn't make contact. Yeah. Okay, maybe if that's the conversation you want to have, that this team didn't put the ball in play, I'm more than willing to go down that route because they had long stretches of times where they were double digits in strikeouts. I mean, they had historic series against the Houston Astros in which they struck out more times than they ever had. But is that more a personnel problem than a philosophy problem?
Well, did we, and by we, I mean Jays management as well, overestimate, you know, what this offense was able to do? They had obviously a historic year last year, but, you know, in September, Goins hits out of his mind. He's not going to do that again 2 years ago. Obviously, the platoon with Colabello didn't exist this year.
Right.
So that affects things. And then you traded some of that surplus in offense in Revere to help your bullpen. Now, it didn't help your bullpen because Storen's not even on the team at this point. But now you have to address, it looks like, maybe the one spot, the 3, 4, 5, 6 spot in your offense, depending on what this roster is going to look like, because you're already at over, you know, you're close to payroll with 8 guys on this roster moving forward, and you're going to lose maybe Edwin and Jose, plus Saunders.
Is there a complacency that comes with sort of the success that they had last year, where it's sort of like you're assuming, well, it doesn't really matter. Like, if I strike out here, that's great. Like, but the next guy's going to hit a home run. And then, you know, if he doesn't, the next guy's going to hit a home run. You know, sort of going forward, they had such a, like, a automatic bailout situation last year. So why would you change your philosophy if you'd seen it work so well?
I don't know if you can even change a guy's philosophy. Like, Jose Bautista's hit 50 home runs in the major leagues. Are you going to tell him to go about it a different way? Is there a need to do that? Like, I think if you want to play a different way, get different players, which they may have to do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Jose's an interesting case because, you know, he was up until the last game, you know, of the ALCS, he was hitting in, you know, below 100, but he was taking his walks still.
Yeah.
This is a guy with an OPS, even though he had a down year of above 800. So it's even really tough to say approach with him because he is a relatively patient hitter when he's not arguing with umpires.
Yeah.
But yeah, when the core of your team, right, is going to make, you know, 103 million, and if we are going to assume the budget's going to be around the same at 50 million, I don't know if you're going to be able to address the offense in a way that it's going to be any better.
Okay, if that's a conversation we want to have, I think that we will see an increase in payroll. Mark Shapiro said that this team is not going to be a top 5 payroll team, but they'll probably be in the next 5, which they are right now. I think they were 10th going into this year. So you hope maybe you make a leap up to 6th, 7th. But this team led the American League in attendance all season long. That was no fluke. They got all their home games except for the World Series games. They got all 3 playoff home games in the American League Championship Series and the DS and the wild card game. So they got all that cake. And the ratings, of course, were great again. Mm-hmm. Plus, you're losing no more R.A. Dickey, not paying him, not paying Jose Bautista, you're not paying Edwin Encarnacion. Michael Saunders there's a number that you lose there that's not nearly as much as the other guys. There's a lot of money coming off the book. So I feel like this team does have plenty of flexibility this offseason to do whatever they want to do. Now, you look at the free agent crop, and maybe that's where your issue lies, but maybe we're looking at trades more with this team anyways.
Yeah, but then... the only real area that you have to trade from with surplus and depth is your starting pitching. And that, although going into the year, we thought it might have been an Achilles heel, it was by far your strength. And the issue is not just the budget. I think the profile of Atkins and, you know, this front office is they've proven, whether it be in Cleveland and now in Toronto, that they're not going to be players at the high end of the free agent market. So, you know, forget about Jose Edwin, guys like Cespedes and Trumbo. Those are not going to be options. So when you look at what your outfield might look like, Melvin Upton Jr.
Oh, that's Pilar. That's a nightmare scenario. Is this if they just go in house for the outfield solutions?
Yeah, but what would be the natural alternative unless you're willing to spend?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways that this Blue Jays team can go. Let's look at where are the trouble areas though. Okay, so let's Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion. They're no longer Blue Jays at this moment. They might re-sign with the Blue Jays, but they're free agents, and they can talk to anybody, and they can go anywhere. So let's just consider them out of the mix. Where are the weaknesses on this spot? All five starting spots in the rotation are filled right now. Blue Jays, there's not a lot of teams in baseball that can say this. The season just ended. You don't have to worry about it acquiring a starter, maybe a guy on a minor league deal who can make a spot start for you. But your major league, your five major league starters, if they're healthy, they step into the rotation on April 1st.
Which is the opposite from this time a year ago. They had to 100%. Fill three spots.
Yep. And they did so admirably.
Yes.
They were incredible. Outfield is the issue. Kevin Pillar is, I think, the only guy you can say for sure, unless he's traded, who's going to be in the opening day lineup in center field. Corner outfield spots. Yeah, you got Melvin Upton Jr. hanging around. Yeah, you got Ezekiel Carrera hanging around. Dalton Pompey, I guess, is a factor at some point, but I don't think you want to go to war with either of those guys as your everyday corner outfielder in either spot. And then first base DH, and then maybe a backup catcher.
We don't believe in Zeke at all at this point? Like,
no.
No.
Not as an everyday player. Like, I think the role he played this year was perfect for him. Guy gets hurt, he can give you a couple of solid weeks playing in a corner outfield spot and do some things, bunt for some base hits, hit the occasional home run, play decent enough defense. In fact, his defense has improved from when he first arrived here. But, yeah, I think if you're the Toronto Blue Jays trying to win an American League East title, can you start Ezekiel Carrera 150 times a season? Probably not. And then there's the bullpen. How do we feel about the bullpen outside of Roberto Osuna?
I mean, I feel like, yeah, outside of Roberto Osuna, which is something, you know, he's obviously been fantastic, and it's unlikely at this point that we see any sort of talk about transitioning to starter like we did last offseason. Joe Biagini, I feel like, was a real revelation. I feel like he's a good piece moving forward. And again, I don't think we're going to see him move to the starter spot like people had talked about. But I do feel like the last two seasons, we've seen the Jays go out to the Royals and to an Indians team that had absolutely mowed down guys, not sort of like, hey, this bullpen isn't as bad as you think. Is that an area that they just sort of look at the trends and they sort of look at playoff baseball and the way it's changing and say, we don't just need a pretty good bullpen. We need the kind of guys that can sort of fill, you know, 8 1/3 innings for us with, like, you know, completely unhittable stuff, just as like that sort of like, you know, all we need to do is get a couple of runs of insurance, and then we knock these guys down with our amazing bullpen. And I don't think the Jays are there yet. I feel like they're a piece or two away from that.
And the other guy who was a revelation was Grilly.
Yeah.
They have a team option, so you assume they exercise that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But two of the guys who are free agents are their two better bullpen arms, Benoit and Cecil. And Cecil, being a left-hander and had a really good postseason, he's probably going to get a multi-year deal for a good chunk of change. And other than him, the next lefty is Aaron Loop.
Right. Like,
so if not Cecil, someone who's a southpaw needs to be in the bullpen who you trust. And it's funny because left-handing players, or lack thereof, is an issue in the everyday lineup as well.
Yeah. The Blue Jays need a little more speed. They need a little more contact, and they need a little more left-handed hitting, I think, is for sure. But I think it is an interesting point you bring up, Craig, in that Major League Baseball is going in this direction of, well, didn't work out so well for the Royals this year, but they have mediocre starters, but if they have a lead after 5 or 6, they go to that incredible shutdown bullpen and they hold it. And you think about how many more wins this Blue Jays team would have had in April and May if they had some guys throwing fire in the 6th, 7th, and 8th leading up to Roberto Osuna. And maybe that is, like, bullpen arms are getting more expensive as the years go along, but it's not a usually a multi-year commitment, maybe a couple of years, 3 years at the most. There are some guys out there that are going to command big dollars. Aroldis Chapman is a free agent at the end of the season. You know, the Yankees are going to be in on him again. I guess adding a guy like that makes sense for this Blue Jays team. Does that solve a couple of issues?
Yeah, well, I mean, look at the NLCS as another example of how important bullpens are, right? The Dodgers have lefties that are, you know, almost unhittable. And Chapman, although he refuses to at this point, pitch more than one inning, you know, he's been a real big find for Chicago. So, yeah, if you're going to expect the offense to come down a little bit, even when you address, you know, the big holes with, you know, two guys who can hit 40 home runs not being in your lineup anymore, then yeah, I think maybe bullpen is the area that you want to invest in heavily, and that's maybe where you spend that money.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly something they should at least have a conversation on. If the price is right, then why not do that? And I feel like for the, you know, Aroldis Chapman not willing to pitch more than one inning, I feel like if you look at sort of the profile that Andrew Miller gained, you know, like obviously it's been building over the course of years, but
yeah,
he won ALCS MVP by sort of playing a non-traditional closer's role. Like he was playing in all sorts of situations. He had four holds, one save. Like that's a guy who is a superstar right now in this playoffs, and he's doing it by sort of being used wherever Terry Francona wants to put him. And I feel like, yeah, if you're Aroldis Chapman, you have to sort of look at that and be like, look at the way my profile could expand based on just being more flexible.
Yeah, things are so different in the playoffs, and bullpen usage has been totally different than we saw during the regular season. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Donovan Bennett on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Before we take the break, let's talk about the manager. John Gibbons is coming back.
Gibby.
Should not be a surprise. Like I said, Blue Jays into the American League Championship Series, second straight year, despite the fact that it took winning a one-game playoff that went to extra innings to do it, and it's a very different conversation if they lose that game, which is stupid. But sports are stupid. That's why we like them. Anybody have an issue or see an issue in John Gibbons returning? Happy with the way he managed this team and his bullpen management is supposed to be his strength, Donovan?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a strength. It didn't seem like a strength for the first third of the year. I'm so indifferent about John Gibbons. I think that's the word that I have to describe my feelings about him and his management. I will say this in his regard. That's a clubhouse with a lot of personalities.
Yeah.
A lot of strong personalities. Jose Bautista, you know, even Donaldson, even to a lesser extent, you know, Tulowitzki. And, you know, managing, I think, the personalities, which in his heyday was Cito Gaston's strength, is a talent. And I think the fact that Gibbons is so laid back and so unassuming is almost best because there's so many peacocks in that locker room. But I always come back to this conversation. If you were to wipe the slate clean and say, okay, this is our roster, this is, you know, our profile for the next 3 or 4 years, this is our philosophies of as an organization, who is the right manager for this team? And you could have your pick of the litter. Would John Gibbons be on your short list?
No, probably not.
But specifically for Atkins and Shapiro, would he be on there? Shortlist because, you know, their relationship is just basically a year old. So I just feel like it's a fait accompli. And when we get to a point where, well, this year, if they were to have missed the playoffs, but
yeah.
If they, you know, at the All-Star break are 5 games below 500, I feel like at some point he's the easy kind of, you know, domino to fall.
Right. And I mean, like ESPN had that sort of survey.
Yeah.
Yeah, during the middle of the season where they...
He was 30th.
He ranked him 30th out of the 30 managers in the league. And, you know, like I feel like that's sort of... That's made him a bit of a polarizing figure. I don't think a lot of people are indifferent about him. I think, you know, you either jump right on board with that and say, like, yeah, he doesn't handle the bullpen as well as we say. You know, he doesn't handle these personalities because we're getting these inconsistent efforts and stuff like that. Whereas other people are saying, look, the manager doesn't have control in a lot of the ways that we're assuming that he does.
Yeah.
And we're giving him crap for stuff that isn't his and isn't his power to change, you know? And yeah, it's one of those things. You look at most Jay's articles and at some point in the comments, there's going to be a war about whether they should fire him like today, like after any given game.
Yeah.
And yeah, like to me, I do feel like he did comport himself well. I feel like getting what he did out of that bullpen situation to me was way more personnel than, you know, than the setup of who he was playing and what numbers he was calling. You know, like you were getting blown saves from Osuna and stuff like that. And people were like, oh, well, look at this, you know, that sort of one run game stat that people were pulling out in the middle of the season. You know, he lost like 30.
A lot of them.
Yeah. So they were like 30 games below 500 over a certain amount of games. And I don't think that was on him as much as people wanted to say. And I feel like he gets, you know, lambasted for stuff that isn't his control.
I think overall, a baseball manager is largely, like, has no impact on the game more than any other sport. Football, number one. Baseball's down there as far as the impact that the field manager can have on wins and losses.
Don't tell that to Orioles fans right now.
Right. Yeah, don't tell that to Zach Britton, whose game-worn jersey went for about $2,000, apparently.
But do you think they have a role in setting a culture? I look at a guy like Joe Maddon, and, you know, we like him. He's good. He's got great sound bites, so on and so forth. But to me, the culture and the aura around the Cubs is completely different since he's been there. And listen, they're you know, one of the most followed franchises in the game, and, you know, they've got, you know, the curse and so on and so forth, which we'll see if they can kind of get back to the World Series for the first time, you know, since any of us have been alive. But I didn't think a manager really had, you know, that big of an influence. But then I look at the difference of the Cubs since he's been there, and granted, he has the best roster in baseball.
Right, I think, like, you're just gonna, like, gloss over that.
But they had good rosters before that, and he did a lot with a little in Tampa Bay, and look at Tampa since he's left.
Yeah, a lot has changed though. They've lost David Price, right? Like, I know what you're saying, and you know, he has also lost a bunch of games with the Rays too, right? Like, it hasn't always been gravy. It's not like he turns every team into a world beater. To me, there's so much as the roster. And I have a little bit of Joe Maddon burnout. That's just me, though.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I get it. He wears the horn-rimmed glasses. He's a cool guy. It's really neat. He knows a lot about wines and pop culture, so that's cool. All right, so we haven't gotten to the elephant in the room when it comes to the Blue Jays this offseason. That is Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion. We'll talk about them coming up. And a little guy I like to call Joey Votto, because you knew I wasn't going to go an entire hour talking about the Blue Jays without bringing up Mr. Votto's name. We'll kick those around. Coming up next, I'm Ben Ennis alongside Donovan Bennett, Craig Battle, Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
It is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Donovan Bennett. Blue Jays done. Losing 5 games in the American League Championship Series. Now the real work begins. What do you do with this team this offseason? As we mentioned, last segment, 5 starters look to be intact, barring a trade. Bullpen, probably some pieces you got to add on to. Certainly corner outfield spots are a question mark, and first base DH. And the reason those are question marks is because Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion are free agents. So is Michael Saunders, but okay. And maybe he comes back. You look at the overall numbers, they're actually not bad. And he was one of the Blue Jays' better offensive players in the playoffs, because there's not a lot to choose from. But this conversation for the next couple of minutes should probably be about Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. And should the Blue Jays? I mean, will they is another question as well. I think there's an argument to be made whether they should go out there and break the bank on both guys, either guys, neither of the guys, Donovan.
Yeah, well, one, I'm much more interested in Edwin than I am Jose.
I think most people are. Yeah.
He's younger. His highs haven't been as high, but he's been much more consistent. So there's that, but I think one, you qualify, and it'll probably be rejected. The interesting thing with Jose's comments in the spring was he alluded to the fact that he understood his value to the organization in being a legacy player, being someone who they're going to bring back, you know, for throwback Fridays 20 years from now. And having his name, you know, at the Rogers Center in the level of excellence. And there is an intrinsic value to that, but it's not a $20 million value.
No.
And that's the thing that I struggle with.
And to me, in retrospect, he knew that at the time. And I think he set himself a number, and that's what he said in the spring training. He said, I'm not going to take less than this. I think, you know, going, you know, I don't want to derail the conversation too much, but that was his moment. Find out how much they were willing to give and get it, because his value was never going to be higher than coming off the bat flip and doing everything he did last playoff series. You know, he was, you know, people were wandering around in t-shirts that they were making themselves, and it was this, you know, huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, he went into the season thinking that this isn't going to change, and injuries and some poor play totally changed that for him. And now he's left looking like the player he is and not the legendary figure he was last offseason.
Yeah, I mean, he thought his value would be higher because he just thought more parties at the table in the open market, his value naturally would go up. And this thing flips so quickly, because if we're having this conversation, you know, 2 weeks ago at the beginning of the Texas series when he's hitting home runs and playing well, and you know Edwin is you know, having his own walk-off type moment with his hands in the air, I feel like the tenor of the conversation is different. But the way the playoffs ended, you're looking at this through a different lens. I would be a terrible GM, because I would just resign everybody.
Well, and also listening to your comments, you're very reactionary as well.
Yes.
Looking at the last 2 weeks, I think GMs generally are taking the whole ball of wax into consideration when they're looking at both guys, and both had different seasons when you look at the whole 162, because Jose didn't play it. He was injured, a couple of different injuries. He's had seasons where he's been healthy. He's had seasons where he's not been healthy. And even as the diminished player he was this year, he did things offensively. Like he was an effective offensive player, not as effective as he's been, but he still did things. And he certainly can take a walk for you, which is a skill. He has on-base skills. So he's going to be coveted out there, not 20 million over 5 years coveted, probably, I don't think. But you never know. There's some dumb and crazy GMs out there, although Dave Stewart is no longer a GM, so the Diamondbacks are probably off the table. I will say, though, as well, I think, and it's not just a reactionary thing to say, that his defense is very much diminished. So you're looking at both of these guys, Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista, as DH first base types, and maybe you can throw Jose out there in right field in a pinch, but I think we've now established that he's a guy you'd like not to be in the outfield.
Well, I mean, Carlos Beltran, you know, ran around in the outfield just hoping the ball wouldn't be hit to him for a while, and still made, you know, a living. So I think there would be a team who could convince themselves that they can play Jose in the outfield for six innings, and when it gets close, you know, have a defensive substitution. The interesting thing for me, and I wonder how you guys feel about this, because I do think a guy like, you know, Dombrowski, who loves stars, would just throw money at him and say, hey, come here, and we've got a short porch in the outfield, just try and hit home runs. Is, you talked about it, Ben, the fact that building was sold out. And for every year, whether it was the Dickey trade or the Reyes trade or the Donaldson trade and the Martin trade, or, you know, the making the playoffs finally and the bat flip, there's always been something to come back for that fan base with some hope. And opening day, there's been a buzz. And if you kind of go into this season doing the same thing you did last year, getting to the same point, and actually winning one less game in the ALCS, and you have a team that is maybe more balanced but not as sexy, are you filling that building to start the year the way you were last year? Say what you want about Bautista and Encarnacion and what they might be like 4 or 5 years from now. There are still a lot of people in that stadium wearing those uniforms. A lot of people wearing parrots on their head. And I argued, and in hindsight it was wrongly, they should have made an offer for David Price, because when he was in town, people were looking at the schedule and saying, when is he pitching? I want to go down to the ballpark. It ended up that people didn't care who was pitching, because everyone was pretty good this year aside from Dickey. So I just wonder if it matters if you have a marquee guy that says, you know what, I'm excited to see this guy play for 162.
I think with Josh Donaldson on the roster and Russell Martin being a fan favorite, and you know, the love for Kevin Pillar continues to amaze me. You know, like it's fantastic. Like I see a ton of love for Kevin Pillar everywhere I go. But I think there's enough fan favorites on the team, and there's a bona fide superstar in Josh Donaldson, and then you've got a potential Cy Young candidate, and you know, Aaron Sanchez, and sort of the you know, inning count will be gone. You know, like this is Aaron Sanchez's time to shine, and Marcus Stroman's a big character, stuff like that. I think you've got enough of those types of guys that just having, like, if you wind up losing Bautista and Encarnacion and sort of replacing those guys with, okay, well, we got a brand new first baseman out here. Even if he's not a superstar, I feel like there's going to be enough new faces.
Well, I thought you were going to segue to the next guy.
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm talking exactly about Joey Votto.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, not Joey Bats, but Joey Votto.
When we get Joey Votto, it's going to be, you know, just amazing.
Yeah, well, I think wins take care of everything, right? And this is a team coming off another ALCS appearance. And if they don't bring those guys back, I think most of the fan base is just kind of, they'd be ecstatic to see either of them re-signed. But I think most people understand that that's not likely to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they could be surprised, but it depends on the other moves. And like you indulge me with, Joey Votto might be one of those moves. Now, maybe it's not likely. Maybe it's not even 30%, but there, you talk to enough people around this team, and Chai Davidi and Arden Zwelling, those guys seem to have an indication that preliminary conversations have definitely taken place between the Blue Jays and Reds, and maybe that's just sussing out the situation. Neither team liked what the other had to say about it, but certainly it does seem like the Reds would be more than willing to move on from Joey Votto, who has a no-trade clause and has 7 years left at over $170 million. But what boggles my mind is you'd sign him to that money today if he was a free agent. Mm-hmm. He's the best hitter in baseball. Say what you want about anybody else. Joey Votto hit over 400 second half of the season. He got on base at like 50, at a rate of 50%. Like he's unbelievable. He is I would say, above average defensive first baseman. He fills a hole on this team. What you'd have to give up to get him is still a bit of a mystery. I suppose it would depend on how much money you'd be willing to retain, and there are a lot of reports that the Reds would be willing to eat some of that money if it meant a bigger return. Are you talking about a roster player? That's a guy that excites the fan base, once again. If that's what you want to talk about, Donovan, if Blue Jays lose Jose and Edwin but get Joey Votto, that's a net win as far as fan excitement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a guy who... you know, you can put on the side of the Rogers Center and people will get excited. The interesting thing is, would he want that sort of attention? And would he be a guy who comes in and says, I'll do, you know, the Votto returns stories in spring training, but, you know, they're going to get old real fast. To me, he seems a little bit like, a recluse, a guy who just, all he wants to do is study pitchers and hit to all fields. Like he's not interested in the endorsements and you know, things after baseball. He just kind of wants to play. And would, you know, all of the attention from, you know, kid from Etobicoke playing in Toronto, would that be something that he'd be interested in?
I think so. I mean, you know, like whether he courts it or not, he's a big name. He's been an MVP. He's essentially that in Cincinnati right now. He's you know, the probably most asked for interview. And sure, certainly he's not the guy that seeks it out. He's not going to try to get all the endorsements. He's not going to be showing up at clubs and stuff. But I feel like, you know, he's a quality player, and he wouldn't be that unlike Troy Tulowitzki on this team, right? Mm-hmm. So there'd be sort of like there's baseball heads. He'd be able to sort of fit in with those guys and, you know, spend hours and hours talking about hitting strategies and stuff like that. And I feel like that would be galvanizing for him. I feel like the makeup of this lineup would fit with his personality.
Yeah, and if you are going to have an outfield as of today who wouldn't profile with power, you know, you would have to flip it somehow, and you now would end up with an infield where your numbers are coming from offensively, with your four best hitters are probably your first baseman, your second baseman, your shortstop, and your third baseman.
Yeah. Right? And speaking about the personality thing and the deferring to of Joey Votto. He wouldn't be the guy that you defer to. There's big personalities, even without Jose Bautista on this team. Josh Donaldson, Troy Tulowitzki, it's seemingly Stroman. Their team. Yeah, Marcus Stroman. Certainly, yeah, there'd be, like you said, beginning of the season, a lot of questions asked of him. He'd have the spotlight on him, and we'd probably be sick of it by the time opening day rolled along.
Right.
But go through a losing streak, maybe he'll be asked to talk occasionally, but the new guy not generally going to be relied to provide answers. The American League MVP from last season, probably going to take up that mantle.
But he's not a free agent. He's not going to come for free or cheap. And your depth is starting pitching. And, you know, the way Aaron Sanchez pitched and his stuff, I would like to think he's untouchable. You have Estrada and Hap on real great deals. I don't know what the market would be like for Liriano. Are you willing to trade a guy like Marcus Stroman to get Votto back?
That's a good question. And are you? And if it's not a roster player and it's one of your better younger players below the major league level, how much of what you do this offseason is, yes, to get better in 2017, but continue to stockpile young prospects with this team? And does it mean blowing that up even more in a move for Joey Votto? I still say it's a move worth doing. But it's probably a conversation we'll get to have a whole bunch before the opening of pitchers and catchers in the middle of February. When we come back, hey, the Maple Leafs are watchable again. Like, really watchable. Entertaining, even. We'll talk about them. Also, the Edmonton Oilers maybe finally pushing for a playoff spot in the Western Conference. Early returns in the NHL season up next. Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Donovan Bennett. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Donovan Bennett with you for another hour. NHL season well underway right now, and some grand proclamations are made, and it's probably too early to do any of that. But let's try and figure out what's real, what's not, as we look at the first half dozen or so games of this National Hockey League season. And let's start, gents, with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who are very much watchable this year. Now, I can't tell if I'm grading on a scale because they were unwatchable last season, save for like the last 10 games or so. And even then, they didn't win. They were just, you know, intriguing a little bit. You know, William Nylander and Nikita Soshnikov and Zach Hyman, the whole bunch that showed up. But this year, they're scoring goals. They've got young players. They've got Austin Matthews. They've got Mitch Marner. They look interesting, to say the least, Donovan, and it does feel like they're back into the consciousness of the Toronto sports fan.
Yeah, I mean, last year, as you mentioned, they were a tough watch. You know, a lot of people were watching them hoping they were losing so they would improve their draft odds. But they were scoring, you know, just over two goals a game. And now every night you sit down, you know you're going to get four goals from them. You know they're probably going to have a lead in the third, and they're probably going to blow it. Yeah. Like, you know what this experience is going to be like. And it's, you're not really, or you shouldn't really stress over it as a Leaf fan, because they're not going to challenge for the Stanley Cup, and they're not going to challenge really for even the eighth seed. These are the growing pains that you're going to get with these kids. The positive is that they are scoring goals and that they do have leads in the first place, and that there is room for improvement. And you know, the offensive firepower that we've all talked about and salivated over is coming to fruition. We knew that, you know, the back end was going to be an issue, and it has been. We thought the goaltending would be better, and you know, it's a long season. They may revert back to being around league average. But If I'm a Leaf fan, this is perfect. It's exciting. It's up-tempo. It's fun. I'm getting a glimpse into what the future might be. And we're still bad, and I can still add another piece to this team. It's perfect.
And I think, like this is the progress that you want to see. And I mean, the Leafs avoided the absolute bottom out for so long precisely because of what we saw last season. Not only were they awful and they lost a bunch of games, but there was a lack of interest. So I think we are grading on a curve right now because there's interest in the team. People want to find out how the Leafs game went. If they missed it, they're anxious. They want to watch the next one. They want to catch the next great Austin Matthews moment or Mitch Marner goal, anything. And that was not there last year, especially in the first half when they didn't bring up those guys that, you know, anybody actually did want to check out. So I think, this is the sort of, we bottomed out. We were really, really bad. We were unwatchable. Now we're going to be watchable and messy and fun if we don't lose. If we don't exactly win a ton of games, that's really not that big a deal. I think what you want to see is sort of player development and then early returns. You're seeing that absolutely, goaltending notwithstanding.
Here's a conversation I've had over the last year, probably on this show a couple of different times. Are the Raptors or the Blue Jays, have they passed the Toronto Maple Leafs as far as fan interest in this city? Are the Leafs now the third most interesting franchise, the third most, attended or viewed franchise in this city? Is that overstated? And are we starting to already see the fruits or the seeds being planted to the Maple Leafs once again being number one in this city? Or is it truly now Blue Jays number one? Now, the two seasons don't overlap, so you don't really have to make a choice in this city. But are the Maple Leafs still number one with a bullet, and any chance people get to pay attention to them, if they're relevant in any way, they're going to garner the most fan interest in the city of Toronto?
I'd say yeah. I'd say they're still last year they were absolutely a sleeping giant, and that they've got this massive fan base, but there was nobody devoted to last year's product. So you wound up with a situation where the Raptors were really interesting, coming off their first. They were coming off a winning season. They've been improving steadily for 3 years. So people were finally coming around to the team, the personalities. They added Bismack Biyombo. They were an exciting brand of basketball, and they were a team that you could count on to win more often than not. They wound up winning a franchise high 56 games. So you wound up with those two poles, one team that's really exciting and improving, and the other team that's totally bottoming out. But I think at the end of the day, the Leafs are not just building up like a classic sort of New Jersey Devils, like trap, like unwatchable winning team. They're building up a team that's exciting and stands to win. And when you've got all those fans just sitting waiting for something exciting to happen, I think you've got a perfect storm. They're going to be a juggernaut again.
Yeah, I think you're right. And last year was the perfect storm for the Raptors. You're hosting the All-Star game, mm-hmm. coming off, great success. You get two guys in the All-Star game, and obviously you go on that playoff run at the same time as no Canadian teams make the playoffs in the NHL,
right.
And the Leafs are terribly bad. But I think the Raptors' growth has been across the country. I don't think that they've gained on the Leafs in their own marketplace in Toronto. I think the Leafs are still the big dog in town. But the difference with the Raptors is when you go across the nation, you don't just see Blue Jays hats now. You see Raptors paraphernalia in We the North. And there are people traveling from different provinces to be a part of Jurassic Park. And I think that's their foothold. But this is, for better or worse, a Leafs town.
Yeah, in 2016, 2017, who has more attention on them, the Toronto Maple Leafs or Toronto Raptors? And we'll get a little more in-depth on the Raptors after we take the break. But like in 2016, 2017, this season, because it was no contest. It was TKO, Raptors, way more interesting by a country mile mm-hmm. over the Toronto Maple Leafs. The Maple Leafs were dead as far as fan interest last season. And it was dormant. We knew it would be revived as soon as they got better and the young players started to play as early as this year. But it's now a conversation, and has it flipped as immediately as one season it was so heavily weighted in the Raptors' favor that it's completely flipped on its axis?
I mean, from a website editor's standpoint here,
yes. Tell me. So you've got the insight. You're looking at the numbers. You can tell me definitively.
not talking about analytics. I'm talking about sort of who it's easier to write a story about right now.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Sorry, I'm. This is like, you know.
I thought you were going to tell me how many page views you were.
Yeah, we've got X number of unique visitors per. No.
What are the impression numbers?
Yeah, exactly. In terms of the Leafs, you've got a number of young, exciting players. You've got storylines night to night. You've got big personalities in the front office and in the coaching box. And basically, you've got a lot of things you can point to, and you just have new stuff, right? Like, you've got new players doing things that we haven't seen from them. Whereas the Raptors at this point, it's flipped. Now the Raptors are a pretty well-known team. They didn't do a lot in the offseason, so there isn't a whole lot of, oh, well, how is X going to perform? Because you're really talking about sort of Jarrett Solinger and a couple of rookies, right? And then, in a micro sense, Jarrett Solinger might not even start the season. So you're really dealing with a team that you dealt with last year. Like, you don't need to know a lot about Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan and these guys because you know them. Like, you've been with them for the last 4 or 5 years. Whereas a lot of the guys in the Leafs, we saw 1,400 Austin Matthews profiles because people didn't know who he was. Like, he'd played in Europe last year, that sort of thing. Like, the name was kicking around, but you didn't have a good sense of the guy.
But you're talking about stories. Like, how about just the games? What would you rather watch if you're just a neutral, you're a fan of both the NBA and the NHL, but you're a sports fan in Toronto? What would you rather watch, the Raptors or the Leafs? Raptors, I think we know who they are. Do we know who the Leafs are? Is it not as easy as it might appear?
Donovan, you go ahead.
Well, no, I just think to piggyback that point, I think a lot of it, too, is what would you rather watch in relation to the dynamic of the leagues themselves? And as sports fans, I mean, it's a bit odd that we invest so much time and so much energy in things that really have nothing to do with our lives. But we do it out of hope. And when you look at these two teams, the Raptors, as good and as consistent as they are, the dynamics of their league and their conference, there isn't really that much hope that they're going to legitimately win an NBA title anytime soon. The age and profile of their best players is the same pretty much as the best players of the Golden State Warriors. So barring some unforeseen magical trade, they're not going to be better than the Warriors anytime soon. But with the Leafs, even though they're not nearly as accomplished as an organization right now, you look at them and you say, well, why can't they be our, our Malkin and Crosby in a couple years? Or, our Taze and Kane? Why can't Marner and Matthews do that for us? And maybe we won't win a cup every year. No one thinks the Oilers of the 80s is coming back, but we could be in that conversation and challenge for one in 4 or 5 years. So I think the hope is why you're invested in the Leafs right now.
Yeah, if players' primes are somewhere in the sort of mid to late 20s, you've got a lot of contributors right now who are in their very early 20s and teen years, right? So that you can project that out moving forward. And then with the Raptors, DeRozan's 27 years old. He's just signed a max contract. He's improved every year, but he's not going to improve the way you would expect Austin Matthews to improve this year to next, or Mitch Marner or something like that. You've got sort of, as much as you have upside left with these guys, you don't have the same type. And then, yeah, like you say, the construction of the NBA and the hurdles in their way, they would need umpteen things to sort of go in their favor. Like, they get, Pascal Siakam winds up turning into like a minor superstar, and the Cleveland Cavaliers totally fall short of their measure, either through injury or players falling off in major ways. You'd need a bunch of things to happen, and so their path to the championship in their sport is just a lot rockier.
It's a lot of positive thoughts around a Leafs team that has one win in four games this season. We mentioned a bunch of third period meltdowns, a couple of them. They've also lost a couple of overtime games, which, you win those, it's a bit of a different feel. We understood that last year was a gimme and they could have done whatever. They finished dead last, which is what was expected of them. I think there would have been some disappointment even if they finished 29th. They finished 30th. Where is the bar this season? At a certain point, do you start to see some sort of fan backlash if it's third period lead after third period lead continuing to be blown? Or if it's, hey, Frederik Andersen did have a great game on that Saturday night against the Boston Bruins. He was number one star, made a bunch of saves. But you can point to a couple of saves in these losses that were not made that changed things. And there might be some hard questions being asked of the Maple Leaf goaltenders moving forward. Is this another write-off year where there, you can't ask any hard questions of the Toronto Maple Leafs and you're just happy with watching the young players continue to grow and wins and losses don't matter? Or at a certain point, if this trend continues where they can't hold a lead in the third period, do people start getting upset? We haven't seen Mike Babcock melt down yet either. And, you know, it's grating on him. At a certain point, is there some accountability with this Leafs team?
Well, Babcock, he also said when he took the job that this is going to take a while. And, you know, your goaltending situation really is a placeholder, you know, for you know, future players that probably profiling the age with your stars, which is relatively young. I does it matter if they finish 9th or 11th or 13th in the conference? Like, no. If anything, again, I'm just a pessimist. Playing really good hockey, having, you know, puck possession, out shooting the other team the way you did against the Wild, and having
nerd Dubnyk, stats.
Yes, exactly. Dubnyk stands on his head and you don't win. That's fine. I'll take that. And I think you should be more concerned with how they're playing than the actual results if you're a Leaf fan.
And I mean, if the trend continues where they're coughing up third period leads and stuff like that, I think, you know, if that does carry over, and I'm not sure that it will, like, we don't know enough about this team to really have a good sense of that. But if that does continue and people get upset, I think that's kind of a good thing. You know, like the fan involvement is what you want. You want people talking about the team. You want people excited in just about any way that manifests. Like last year, there was no, you know, hand wringing really, because there was nothing really to wring your hands over. You weren't expecting to see much of anything out of the team, so nobody was watching. This year, if that's the takeaway, that, you know, you wind up with people getting frustrated about a team that's not ready yet, I think that's good.
But it really should be expected. Like, this is a team learning to walk in front of your eyes with so many young guys playing, you know, so much big minutes and getting lots of ice time. They're going to have missteps. They're literally a baby, and babies are cute and fun, but they...
Well, they're not literally a baby.
Well, I guess they're not literally a baby, but in hockey terms, they're babies.
Yeah.
But babies spill food all over themselves, and you forgive it, because that's what they do. So, yeah, if this was a trend, you know, 2-3 years from now, I think it would be a concern, but it's to be expected in my eyes. It would be, you know, alarming if they didn't, really. The fact that they have a lead in the first place is the plus.
Yeah, and this baby has pooped itself in the third period a couple of times.
And the non-dad at the table here is talking about, you know, you don't get frustrated with these things.
No, you totally keep an even keel when you're on like an hour and a half sleep. No, it's fine. Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Donovan Bennett, and Craig Battle. One of those teams that I don't think has any more moral victories is the Edmonton Oilers. And I know it's just season two of Connor McDavid, but they've been going through this rebuild thing for 1,000 years. Hey, and wouldn't you know it, they actually have some wins up on the board so far this season. They are 4-1 in their five games to start the season with their 8 points. But their coach has been harsh on him a couple of times. Todd McLellan, Benoit Pouliot, he called out early in the season for a number of penalties he's taken. What have we seen early days for the Oilers here, Craig?
That post-game presser really kind of surprised me. And it's not that I think it's going to really haunt them or anything. I just thought it was sort of interesting, you know, for a sport that sort of values sort of handling things in the right way and keeping a stiff upper lip and keeping things in the room and stuff like that, to sort of come out after a game when you're, you know, you won 2 straight to start the season and you lose a game badly. That 6-2 game did not look good in just about any phase of Edmonton's game. Mm-hmm. But to say that you can't fix stupid or something like that and, you know, throw him under the bus in such a, like, you know, you made the statement, like he played 3 minutes. You can say that, look, we've got to clean some stuff up here. You know, you can give them banalities. Like, this was a bad game for us and we're hoping to put it behind us, but it's early. Like, you can get away at that point with saying it's early, and he did not. And I'm wondering, like, was that a calculated thing that he's like, I want everybody in this room to know that I'm going to throw you under the bus if you screw up?
Or is he just frustrated in year two already?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, frustrated in year two. That does not bode well moving forward because, you know, to Donovan's point, there's a lot of babies on this team too, and they're going to have bad nights.
Yeah, and I think they're on the other end of that spectrum where they moved some of those young pieces for a little bit more veterans in the room. The issue, though, is, yeah, the loss to Buffalo bad, specifically when Eichel, Kane not in the lineup. But already you're panicking. You're changing McDavid's line. You know, there was a mandatory day off, and because of the CBA, you say, scratch that, we're practicing. Just the fact that you're panicking this early and you're calling your team out saying they weren't ready to play, well, isn't that your job to get them ready to play? Like, it just, to me, is such an alarming move so early.
Well, they seem to take it so personally. Like, I told you guys to play well, and you didn't play well, and now I'm really angry about it, like, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense three games of the season. That's sort of the, you know, the coach on his way out screaming at the rafters saying, look, I said everything right, and they didn't do it. It's not my fault. Like, he's not on the hot seat three games into a season when they're 2-1.
Mm-hmm. No, they've actually won some games, which is just they're not used to that in Edmonton. And who knows if it continues, but right now things looking pretty good. They've got a couple of wins over Calgary, who's off to a horrible start this season.
But imagine if a player said, you know what, we weren't ready to start the game, and that's on our coach. He didn't get us ready to start the game. Right. It would be World War III.
That's amazing. Yeah. I never even thought about that possibility. Yeah, what would happen? The coach would have to respond in some way. It wouldn't be pretty. No. It wouldn't. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about the upcoming NBA season, which is about to crank up. And yes, it's going to be fun to watch the Raptors, but yes, it's going to be fun to watch the Golden State Warriors and how many victories they are going to put up this season. 80-2, so that's a nice round number. We'll talk about that. Cavaliers, the Boston Celtics, and the additions they made in the offseason, and of course, break down your Toronto Raptors. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Donovan Bennett, Craig Battle. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Gare Joyce.
The world's largest pressure cooker sits at the foot of Bay Street, the Air Canada Centre, the home of the Toronto Maple Leafs. A lot of veterans have ridden in on a wave of hype and hope and melted in the heat. Submitted into evidence, Exhibit 1, David Clarkson. It's also a place where young players struggle mightily to live up to expectations. The one teenager who fit in from day one is Morgan Riley, the blue liner from Vancouver by way of Moose Jaw. Brian Burke crowed about landing Riley with the fifth pick back in the 2012 draft. Said he would have selected Riley if the Leafs had the first overall pick.
And with our first selection in the 2012 entry draft, the Toronto Maple Leafs are pleased to select from the Moose Jaw Warriors of the Western Hockey League and the Canadian Hockey League, Morgan Riley.
Somehow, Riley held up. More than held up, really. Riley was impressive with Team North America in the World Cup in September. It was a real coming out party. I talked to Riley about how he handled the pressure in the market that eats its young too many times. Auston Matthews and Mitch Marner and all the kids in the Toronto system can go to school on the experiences of Morgan Riley.
Holy mackerel, what a shot from Morgan Riley!
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine on newsstands now. And available on Texture by Next Issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones. As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Radio Network. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Donovan Bennett, Craig Battle with you until the top of the hour. Raptors open up their season against the Detroit Pistons on Wednesday. This is a team coming off an Eastern Conference final appearance. And here's the facts. I know it may seem crazy, but I can't avoid this reality. They were 6 wins away from winning the NBA championship season ago. Mm-hmm. Okay? It was unlikely, but they pushed the eventual champions to a 6th game in that Eastern Conference Final. What do they have in store in 2016-2017? That's a real interesting question, gents. This is the question I asked you before we started today, Donovan, because I haven't heard many people make the argument that this team is better than the one that made it to a sixth game of an Eastern Conference Final a season ago. Can you make that argument?
Yeah, I think they're better. And it's funny because they are a better basketball team, but they might not end up with a better record because, relatively speaking, the rest of the East, I think, once again got better. But, yes, they lose Bismack. You know, is he worth, you know, upwards of $17, $18 million a year? Probably not. But at this time last year, Bismack was, you know, a bit part. Didn't really know what you were going to get from him. He obviously exceeded that, but even in the playoffs, he was only a factor after JV got hurt. You have Siakam and Poeltl, who day one won't be better than him, but offensively profile better than him. And, you know, those are pieces that, you know, 2-3 years down the line, you think will be big parts of your organization. A guy like Norman Powell, who at this time of the year wasn't a factor in the rotation whatsoever, he'll play a much bigger part and will be with the team for all 82 games. And if you just trade it up, heads up for, you know, Scola and swapping in Sullinger, that's a massive upgrade at the four position. Now, Sullinger's not healthy, but it's not something that'll keep him out for the entire year. And Damari Carroll, who really was the free agent signing everyone was excited about last year, he only played 26 games. And many of those games he played, he wasn't healthy. So with another offseason, still not fully healthy, but hopefully you're expecting him to play, what, at least 60 games? That in itself, having a 3-and-D guy beside DeMar DeRozan, someone who struggles to hit threes and struggles to defend, is really, really important. And having another floor spacer is important. So, yeah, I do think that it's tough to see the change because they didn't make a big splash, but I think that there'll be a subtle improvements throughout the roster that'll make them a better basketball team.
I could see, yeah, like I agree, Donovan. I think they're going to take a step back in terms of their record. Like I could see sort of like the Damari Carroll situation worries me a little bit just because
he's I can't believe he's still not at 100%.
No, that seems to me sort of a crazy situation. He was playing in the playoffs last year and yeah, he certainly didn't look like himself, but he did provide, you know, value. Like he was you know, an important part of that team in the sort of the minutes he was able to play. And that you have all that offseason time to fully recover and you come in and you're still not 100%. And I wonder if he's ever going to be 100% now. And that sort of worries me moving forward, especially because with Sullinger out, you know, you could see him playing a lot more small ball power forward. It makes more sense to put him there. And then you wind up with more minutes that way, probably for Norman Powell, whose pathway to playing time right now seems a little bit shaky just because Terrence Ross is there and Corey Joseph. And you got like this second unit that's pretty well established. And you don't like to play without Lowry or DeRozan. Like you want one of those guys on the floor. So, you know, if you wind up with more minutes for Norman Powell this way, then that seems to me a way that you fill those minutes. But yeah, losing Bismack, I think, hurts this team. You know, like you said, he wasn't that guy at the beginning of last season. He was just a guy that you sort of expected rebounding and blocks from. And he wound up being a really galvanizing player and infectious energy, which the team really needed. So yeah, I could see them taking a step back, but I do feel like, you know, I think it's underplayed how much DeRozan improves each season. And I don't see him as a guy who takes his money and says, okay, that's good, I'm done. Like, he's a total gym rat. He likes to be in there. He likes to improve. His handle can always improve. His defense can always improve.
Three-point shooting can improve.
Exactly. So he's a really valuable player with still holes in his game, and I think he's going to continue to address those holes. And they will continue that upward trend towards the challenging, the best backcourts in the league.
One of the, I think for a lot of people, one of the frustrating aspects of this Raptors team can be the offense at times looking stagnant and how reliant they are on their two guards to create the offense and how much the ball can stick and the lack of assists at times. Is it just, are we at the point in 2016-2017 where you just throw your hands up and say, this is what they are? They're going to score through their guards. That's what they do. And you know what? Their guards are pretty good at scoring. One-on-one, they're pretty good offensive creators. This is how this Raptors team is going to win games. And you know what? They made it to an Eastern Conference Final in a sixth game of it doing just that. It wasn't pretty at times the first couple of series in the postseason. Mm-hmm. Yep. But they won a couple of game sevens doing it this way. Or is there still, does there need to be a continued focus on sharing the ball and maybe getting it down to Jonas Valanciunas? Because what at times when they finally do decide to give it to the big man, to spread it around, to play like a three-headed offensive monster, they can look seriously dangerous. They just haven't done it consistently enough.
Yeah, we saw that in the series against Miami where he, you know, played really well against Hassan Whiteside, you know, a good defensive center. And he will be the guy who dictates that change and demands.
You think? Oh, come on. I hate that argument, though. What's he supposed to do? He can't rip the ball out of their hands.
No, I say that meaning his progression.
Oh, I see.
Him becoming, you know, more comfortable, his work with Sigma and working on his post moves. Because there is no other player on this team that you're going to, by default, you know, find more usage rate for offensively. I think other than that, yeah, that's going to be their offense because who else is really a creator of shots? Not really. Corey Joseph, a little bit, but not really.
Yeah.
Terrence Ross is reluctant to get in the paint at the best of times. And Patrick Patterson is a guy who feasts off of, you know, drive and kick penetration by those two guys. So, yeah, I think for the most part, for them to score, you have to roll the ball to them offensively and say, make something happen for yourself or for us.
And that can be frustrating at times.
I think.
And I don't know if it's frustrating for Dwayne Casey as well, but it can be frustrating to watch. I mean, it was frustrating a couple of series, despite the fact the Raptors won both of them against the Pacers, against the Heat. And it is amazing that, you talk about how Jonas Valanciunas against the Heat started to dominate, and they started to look like a real cohesive unit offensively that looked really, really dangerous. And they went away from it. And when they had the National American spotlight on them because it was the playoffs, you heard some real smart basketball people saying, why are you going away from Jonas Valanciunas? But they still never went back to him.
Yeah, and I could see, you know, I would like to see a sort of, okay, he's been with us for a few years now. We know what he is in those first three games in the Miami series. He was playing as well as anybody on the court, you know, three double-doubles in a row. And you would like to see some progression from those guys, just sort of like DeRozan and Lowry know the game. And I know that they take a lot of shots that we would consider questionable, especially towards sort of the end of quarters. But once you've seen, and they went to him in those games, they relied on him. Like they were looking towards him and he was succeeding. So I think if that carries over to the beginning of the season, we won't see them abandon JV. Like last year, we'd sort of see situations where five possessions in a row, they would go to him, and all of a sudden it'd be like 2 minutes into the game and JV has 8 points, and he winds up finishing with 10 because they didn't pass the ball to him again. I'd like to see that eliminated, and I'd hope that that was part of the plan going forward.
The other onus that JV has is not just improving his back-to-the-basket game offensively, but also being a better passer out of the double team.
Yes.
Because, you know,
quicker passer.
Yeah. Because you're going to be reluctant to throw it in there knowing that it may never get back out to you.
Right.
And that's something that he struggled with, recognizing the double team and recognize the correct pass out of it. And he doesn't really fit with really DeMar, and to a lesser extent, but still Kyle, because he's not a pick and pop player. He's not someone who's going to be able to shoot from 15 to 18 feet consecutively night in, night out. You know, and those guys are heavy pick and roll players. So he almost makes more sense being a featured guy in the second unit where you have someone like Terrence Ross and Patrick Patterson who can stand behind the three-point arc and give him space to operate.
And I think, well, like this is a Casey thing for me because that, like, you know, him not passing out of the double team, I think oftentimes it's not necessarily technique or recognition. It's trust and, like, are you going to get that ball back if you kick it out? Like, this is a situation where it's like, if he has faith that whether he gets it back as on a repost or whether he gets it back later in the possession or in the next possession, he has to feel like the ball isn't just going to leave him for the next quarter. Like you abandon a situation and you just don't get another opportunity. And that's where sort of a more consistent play calling. Sure, you don't want to, you know, totally derail what DeRozan and Kyle Lowry do and their freedom on the court, but you do want to have a situation where everybody feels like they're going to get the requisite opportunities that, you know, equal their talent and what they can provide.
I think trust is a great word, and also trust that you're going to allow me to play through my mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when I watch JV play, specifically in the regular season, feel like he's playing the first three quarters as an audition to be allowed to play in the fourth
That's
quarter.
Right. Yeah.
And if he makes a bunch of mistakes, then he's not going to play at all in the fourth quarter. And if he's hot and has the hot hand, he'll play in the fourth quarter until it gets really close, and then he won't play. And without Bismack, I think, you know, Dwayne Casey by default has no choice but to play him in more big-time situations. And hopefully maybe that relaxes JV a bit, because you're right. There is a sense that he's like, oh, I've got the ball. I got to do something because I got to put it on my resume so I can play in meaningful minutes in this game.
Right. We mentioned how much of the fan interest around the Maple Leafs is the unknown and the young players, the rookies. There is some unknown when it comes to the Raptors, and they had a couple of first-round picks, and maybe some, if not both, will play significant minutes. Pascal Siakam was a guy that was very much unknown when he was drafted, a guy who's a very raw, skilled guy, probably needs some refinement on the offensive side of things, but athletic and a real worker, apparently. Jakob Poeltl, by all accounts, was the safe choice at 10 to be the big 7-footer that can do some things, maybe come off the bench as one of your first replacements for Jonas Valanciunas. What is the outlook and the expectation of both of those guys? Early season, you imagine as rookies, it's going to be difficult to really find their way, but maybe by the end of the season, they're playing significant roles with this team?
Yeah, I think that we're going to see more of them, especially Pascal Siakam, than anybody sort of would have guessed sort of at draft night, when people were sort of expecting that one of the guys who'd fallen in that draft were going to wind up with the Raptors. He got a surprise vote. The NBA does this vote among sort of rookies, who's going to be rookie of the year, who's going to be MVP, et cetera, et cetera. And Pascal Siakam got a surprise vote in that thing. So some other NBA draftee really believes that he's going to get both opportunity and he's going to shine. And last with the Raptors preseason game on Friday night against the Wizards, they actually started Siakam in favor of Patrick Patterson because Solinger was out. So he might wind up getting those extra minutes and that extra profile just because of that. And if he gets some confidence and they can figure out a role for him, that could be really big going forward.
Yeah, it's interesting because he also got a vote in the GM survey as steal of the draft.
Yeah.
And when you look at, we look at Siakam and Poeltl as kind of a pair, and we look at Bebe and Bruno as a coupled pair, and Powell and DeLon Wright as a coupled pair. And the guys who, you know, are less heralded in all three of those groupings, I think are going to make much more of an impact on this team. I think Siakam is going to be a part of the rotation far ahead of Poeltl. Bebe, when healthy, is going to get roster minutes. Bruno is not. And DeLon Wright, obviously, he's going to be injured for the first half of the year with a shoulder ailment, which helps his development. But talking about a path to play, if Fred VanVleet is part of this 15-man squad, that muddles things as far as, you know, the point guard situation. Mm-hmm. But I think Siakam is a guy who, by the end of the year, a lot of the things we said about Bismack from a qualitative standpoint, we'll be saying about him.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And certainly it's a little easier to figure out the defensive side of things as a rookie, I would imagine. And you're just really athletic, and you just use your athleticism, use your youth to your favor. Maybe it's a little easier for Pascal Siakam to get his feet under him defensively as he starts his NBA career. 11:46, Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Donovan Bennett, Craig Battle. Let's look around the rest of the NBA for a sec, Salwi Gents. And, of course, the focus is going to be almost entirely on the Golden State Warriors, that historic run a season ago, blowing a 3-1 series advantage in the NBA Finals. I don't know if you're aware of that. They were up 3-1.
Really?
And they didn't win.
That's a story.
And what a Game 7 against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Everyone's pretty much anointed them as the champions of the NBA in 2016-2017. Is that fair? Like, it seems fair. You go from a team that won a historic number of games and you add one of the best players in the NBA to it. That seems reasonable, doesn't it, Donovan?
Well, listen, I would bet anything I own that they're going to win. However, I would have done the same thing when they were up 3-1
yes.
and they had won 73 games.
Yeah.
So that's why they play the games. And when you look at Kevin Durant, a guy who's had a, you know, history with foot ailments. Steph Curry hasn't the last 2 years, but historically he's had issues with his ankles. If they actually could survive one catastrophic injury, but two, maybe that's a different conversation. But the thing that might derail them, and I don't think it will, but might, is all of the conversation. Already there's the stories about Draymond Green being a cancer and then Klay Thompson having to answer that. And, you know, everything Kevin Durant says is going to be, you know, a top of a byline. Mm-hmm. You got a sense at the end of last year that the emotional baggage is what exhausted them of going for the win streak to start the year and then going for 73 and trying to repeat. And that could be something that derails them when the Cavs are the defending champs and we're not really talking about them.
No, we're not.
No. And I mean, just to cap off the Warriors here, I feel like, you know, like you say, if you're taking one team to win the title, I think it has to be the Warriors right now. I like the Cavs a lot. I think they've got a ton of talent. LeBron last year, again in the playoffs, proved why he's sort of the most versatile, most valuable player that we've seen this generation. The Warriors have so much talent. But we've seen talent collections like this implode in the past. We've seen Shaq and Kobe and Gary Payton and Karl Malone. We've got four Hall of Famers all together, and it didn't work for them. We've got, obviously having this many current all-NBA players together, I don't even think that's happened before. But they have, you know, sort of situations where they're comfortable and they're not going to necessarily get them. Like, Curry can't dominate possessions the way he did last year with Durant standing beside him. And Durant isn't a good enough defender to sort of have a major impact if he's not getting the ball all the time. Like, you're going to wind up with situations where everybody wants to be the one taking a shot and you've only got one ball. And I think that wears on a team. I don't know. It's like Durant had to share the ball in Oklahoma City with Russell Westbrook. Now he's got to share it with Klay Thompson and Draymond Green and Steph Curry, one of the most high volume players in the history of the NBA. And before, you're replacing guys who were really happy deferring offense, right? Like, you had Harrison Barnes, who was really cool to stand in the corner and wait for a three. Like, just,
and then miss it in the postseason.
Yeah, he was not good. And so that's, you have no problem letting that guy go, but he was a good guy for their chemistry. You had Andrew Bogut, who was a great sort of veteran presence, personality guy. Now he's in Dallas as well. You've got guys who left, like Maurice Spates was your nice, like, you know, everybody else is leaving early, throw in Maurice Spates there and he'll make some shots. You have sort of, I don't think they're going to win 70 games this year, despite the talent that they've got.
Not to mention, and I feel like the Spurs are very much going into the season under the radar. Yes, Tim Duncan's gone. They added Pau Gasol, right? Like, they added one of these Hall of Fame guys, certainly in the twilight of his career. But this was an outstanding team a season ago, gave the Warriors a run for their money every time they faced each other during the regular season, couldn't get past the Thunder. But are we sleeping on the Spurs a little bit in the West?
Well, I do like the addition of Gasol. The issue, though, is losing Tim Duncan, adding Gasol, that's obviously a net positive, but it's not on the defensive end. So you have two big men in Gasol and Aldridge who aren't the best defenders. Actually, on the perimeter with an aging Ginobili and Parker, not great defenders. And so Kawhi obviously is the best defender in the league, and Danny Green, a plus defender on the wings. Your wings are great defenders, but the Spurs, their hallmark is defense. And when you look at the top end of the rotation, they're not actually that great defensively. I do think the Warriors are going to win 70. I think they're going to win literally as many games as they care to. You know, it depends how interested they are down the stretch. Just because there are issues with who gets shots and so on and so forth. But at the pace they play, they're going to have so many possessions. Everyone's going to get touches. And they all can shoot, and they're all in their prime. And for a defense, who do you double team? Like, I just think they all attract so much attention that by default, you're going to have some odd scenes with people wide open for threes just because you're so used to running at Steph Curry and double teaming him, not thinking that, oh, yeah, the guy I'm leaving is Klay Thompson.
Yeah, it's pretty nutty when you look at the rotation, when you look at the depth chart for the Golden State Warriors, and their season gets underway on Tuesday. Raptors play on Wednesday against the Pistons. How about this for one of the three season opening games on Tuesday? Spurs at Golden State, 10:30 game.
On Sportsnet.
Yeah. I have a small child, so it'd be tough to stay up that late to watch it, but you can on Sportsnet. And, of course, you can listen to Free Association Sportsnet's basketball podcast on sportsnet.ca and iTunes. Thanks, gents. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. For Donovan Bennett, Craig Battle, I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.